Facts are stubborn things, and whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passions, they cannot alter the state of the facts and evidence.
On a cold, moonlit night near an icy Boston harbor in 1770, wearing the red coats that earned them their nickname, a small platoon of British soldiers stood in a ragtag semicircle. They came to protect a lone sentry who had retreated to Boston's old state house from a gathering crowd of colonists, infuriated with everything English. Coming to his aid, the soldiers stood shoulder to shoulder, aiming loaded muskets with bayonets mounted as an even larger, riotous crowd gathered in front of them. With his sword drawn, British Captain Thomas Preston positioned himself in front of his men, hoping to defuse a dangerous situation and calm the angry colonists. Facing those pointed bayonets was a surly crowd of some 200 rough New England dock workers and young miscreants, taking out their frustrations initially on the sentry and then the newly arrived King's men. The crowd hurled snowballs, chunks of ice, and oyster shells at the soldiers. They taunted the soldiers by yelling, "Fire!" attempting to bait them into shooting. Swelled by an unchecked gang mentality, the crowd inched closer to the platoon. One sailor, Crispus Attucks, grabbed a bat used by dock workers and stood at the edge of the crowd immediately next to the redcoats. Attucks swung the bat and knocked Private Hugh Montgomery to the ground, who, as he rose, yelled to his brethren, "Fire, damn you, fire!" And the musket shots rang out. When the smoke cleared from the several soldiers' now empty musket barrels, five Bostonians lay on the cold, hard ground with their red blood freezing in the snow. Three were dead, including Attucks, and two more mortally injured who would die in the following days. The next day, colonists predicted that the accused British soldiers would all hang for the murder of the five unarmed civilians, especially when judged by a Boston jury. But John Adams, then a 34-year-old lawyer, took on the most unpopular defense of the soldiers and orchestrated their trials in a way that defied conventional thinking.
I jumped back and heard a voice cry, "Fire!" The officer was standing before me with his face towards the people.
The soldiers pushed several persons with the bayonets, driving through the people in so rough a manner that it appeared they intended to create a disturbance.
I was at home when the guns were fired. I went up to the main guard and addressed myself to the captain and said to him, "What have you done?"
"Please, pull up a chair and have a seat with me at the council table. You're going to sit right next to the lawyers while they cross-examine witnesses, fight off objections from opposing counsel, and deal with anxious defendants facing big fines, long jail terms, and even death sentences. You'll also have a front row seat in the jury box as you listen to the testimonies straight from the witnesses. And then, after hearing the final verdict, you can decide whether the rulings were correct or not." Hi everyone, my name is J. Craig Williams, and welcome to In Dispute. In this podcast miniseries, we will look back at 10 famous court cases that stand out for their historical importance, their contrasts with today's modern criminal trials, and their unusual outcomes. Some historians disagree about the events I've related and am about to relate in this episode, but thankfully, a transcript of the soldiers' trial exists in the Library of Congress, and other publications there contain snippets of history, allowing us a modern-day legal look back at the trials. To understand the Boston Massacre, we must first bring several other historic events in the prior 3 years into focus. Initially, the British Parliament passed the Townshend Tax Acts on June 29, 1767. These acts imposed more taxes on products imported into the colonies, such as glass, paper, rum, wine, molasses, sugar, and of course, tea. Parliament also imposed taxes on court documents, certificates, licenses, deeds, playing cards, pamphlets, books, and newspapers. The colonists were firmly under the thumb of British rule, but Bostonians rebelled and refused to pay the taxes. In October 1768, 2 years before the massacre, British troops arrived in Boston to restore order and collect taxes for the commissioners of customs and ultimately King George III. Once settled on colonial soil, the British troops regularly patrolled the streets of Boston, treating the colonists rudely and showing an outright disrespect for the lower class dock workers. Secure now, with troops behind them, the commissioners of customs collected taxes more easily and with higher success, demoralizing shop owners and manufacturers who passed on those higher taxes to the colonists, ultimately frustrating the wider Boston population. This behavior occurred with more frequency and severity, culminating with the Boston Massacre. That evening's events, however, started with an otherwise nondescript confrontation, the complaints of a local wig maker's apprentice to a British lieutenant captain regarding payment for his master's work on the officer's wig. On the night of March 5, 1770, Private Hugh White stood a lonely sentry's watch on Boston's King Street, just outside the customs house where the commissioners collected their taxes and stored their levies, awaiting transport to England. As was common at the time, an off-duty officer walked about King Street in his bright red uniform. Nearby, a wig maker's apprentice, Edward Garrick, spotted the British officer and called out, "There goes a fellow who hath not paid my master for dressing his hair." Private White responded to Garrick's criticisms. "He is a gentleman, and if he owes you anything, he will pay for it." Garrick countered with, "There are no gentlemen left in the regiment." In response, Private White left his post and confronted Garrick, engaging in a heated exchange of words. With the butt end of his musket to make his point, the soldier struck Garrick, knocking him down. As Garrick laid in the snow and cried in pain, one of his companions, Bartholomew Broders, took up the argument with White. "Bloody lobster back, lousy rascal, lobster son of a bitch," Broders yelled at White, soon joined in by others. Attracted by the noise, a crowd of about 50 colonists gathered from nearby bars and houses. Pouring into the street, they threw chunks of ice and other missiles at White, who retreated for his safety to his sentry box, loaded his musket, and waved it at the now angry colonists to keep them away. The crowd continued to grow, and in fear for his life, Private White retreated to the customs house on King Street, where the nearby British main guard slept. Then, someone rang the fire bell at the old brick meeting house, which drew curious onlookers who expected to see flames. Other bells in nearby church steeples rang, drawing a crowd of 300 to 400 colonists. As Captain Thomas Preston would later state in his deposition on March 13, 1770, about 9 of the guard came too and informed me that the town inhabitants were assembling to attack the troops and that the bells were ringing as the signal for that purpose and not for fire. All the colonists streamed toward King Street, the customs house, and the main guard. At the main guard, Captain Thomas Preston watched the powder keg of his situation. Preston, Lieutenant James Bassett, Corporal William Weems, and 6 privates moved from the main guard to the customs house in a column of 2 with their bayonets drawn. The crowd of colonists pressed around the soldiers as they formed a semicircle and joined up with Private White, all with their backs to the locked doors of the customs house and the King's ransom. The rabble had separated briefly to let the bayoneted guns and men through, but still hurled insults at them. Captain Preston described the scene in his deposition just a week after the event.
"The mob still increased and were more outrageous, striking their clubs or bludgeons one against another and calling out, 'Come on, you rascals, you bloody backs, you lobster scoundrels, fire if you dare, fire and be damned. We know you dare not.' And much more such language was used. At this time, I was between the soldiers and the mob, and endeavouring all in my power to persuade them to retire peacefully, but to no purpose. They advanced to the point of the bayonets, struck some of them, and even the muzzles of the pieces, and seemed to be endeavouring to close up the soldiers, on which some well-behaved persons asked me if the guns were charged. I replied yes. They then asked me if I intended to order the men to fire. I answered no, by no means, observing to them that I was advanced before the muzzles and must fall a sacrifice if they fired."
Not everyone sees things the same way. In March 1770, according to an anonymous account of the Boston Massacre, a short narrative of the horrid massacre in Boston, printed by the Order of the Town of Boston, the event was quite different. Some believe Samuel Adams helped write this narrative document, given his instigation of the events leading up to that night.
In passing to this station, the soldiers pushed several persons with the bayonets, driving through the people in so rough a manner that it appeared they intended to create a disturbance. This occasioned some snowballs to be thrown at them, which seemed to have been the only provocation that was given. Mr. Knox declares that while he was talking with Captain Preston, the soldiers of his detachment had attacked the people with their bayonets, and that there was not the least provocation given to Captain Preston of his party, the backs of the people being toward them when the people were attacked. He also declares that Captain Preston seemed to be in great haste and much agitated, and that, according to his opinion, there were not then present in King Street above 70 or 80 persons at that extent. Captain Preston is said to have ordered them to fire and to have repeated that order. One gun was fired first, then others in succession and with deliberation, till 10 or a dozen guns were fired, by which means 11 persons were killed and wounded, as above represented.
Despite what the differing accounts say, all agree on one thing. The British soldiers fired at the colonists, and 5 were killed. Preston and his men were arrested the same evening the shots were fired. All were charged with murder. Tensions were high, and a committee of citizens formed to seek the removal of the troops from Boston. Realizing the danger of the situation, Governor Barnard re-garrisoned the British troops at Castle William in the harbor outside the city. He also postponed the trials by some 8 months, and the soldiers remained in jail pending their trial. For reasons we don't know, Captain Preston was tried separately from the soldiers, with John Adams handling his defense as well as the defense of the soldiers. On October 21st, the soldiers objected in a letter to the court.
"We poor distressed prisoners beg that ye would be so good as to let us have our trial at the same time with our captain. For we did our captain's orders, and if we do not obey his command, should have been confined and shot for not doing it."
Although this request was denied, no written explanation for it exists. Modern ethical rules require an attorney for each separate defendant. So by present-day standards, John Adams should not have represented all 9 criminal defendants. The very fact that the soldiers complained about the separate trials should have raised questions of ethics in Adams' mind, but historical records do not disclose his reasoning on this point. As it turned out, the soldiers were right to fear 2 trials. Preston's best defense lay in his denial that he gave any orders to fire at the colonists. Preston, in fact, claimed exactly that in his deposition, arguing that he would never have issued that order while he stood between his men and the colonists. John Adams advanced that theory in Preston's trial. John Adams' conflict of interest in representing both the captain and the soldiers in separate trials arose from the soldiers' need to blame Captain Preston and his need to blame them. Directly contrary to their captain's best argument, the soldiers' best defense arose from their claim that they had simply followed their captain's orders, a defense commonly asserted in military trials. Preston's separate trial started some 8 months after the Boston Massacre and took 6 days from October 24th to October 30th, 1770. The second trial of the soldiers started about a month later on November 27th, 1770, but lasted 2 weeks. Because the colonies were still under British rule, all would be tried according to English law.
Today's legal news is rarely as straightforward as the headlines that accompany them. On Lawyer to Lawyer, we provide the legal perspective you need to better understand the current events that shape our society. Join me, Craig Williams, and a wide variety of industry experts as we break down the top stories. Follow Lawyer to Lawyer on the Legal Talk Network or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
You like legal podcasts because you're curious and want to be the best attorney you can be. I'm Dave Scriven-Young, host of Litigation Radio, produced by ABA's Litigation Section with Legal Talk Network. Search in your favorite podcast player for Litigation Radio to join me and my guests as we examine hot topics in litigation and topics that will help you to develop your litigation skills and build your practice. I hope you'll check out Litigation Radio and join the ABA Litigation Section for access to all of the resources, relationships, and referrals you need to thrive as a litigator.
Robert Treat Payne and Samuel Quincy led the prosecution. John Adams defended both Preston and the soldiers in the separate trials. Joining Adams as defense counsel for Captain Preston was Robert Auchmuty Jr., who was a judge of the Vice Admiralty Court and a loyalist to the Crown. Also with Adams was a much younger Josiah Quincy Jr., who was Prosecutor Samuel's younger brother, and Samson Salter Blowers, another Crown loyalist. In this first trial, Rex versus Preston, the jurors had to determine whether Preston gave the order to fire on the colonists. Although no transcript of this six-day trial is known to exist, historians have pieced together snippets of the testimony from other sources. Court reporter John Hogston originally transcribed the trial in shorthand, but as John Adams observed, the British government have never permitted it to see the light and probably never will. Preston's trial is believed to be the first in the colonies to have lasted longer than one day. As with all criminal trials, the prosecution started first. Samuel Quincy opened and first called Edward Garrick, the apprentice wigmaker. After describing his altercation with Private Hugh White, Garrick admitted that he taunted the soldier. He described the blow struck by White with the end of White's musket and testified that he saw soldiers in the streets carrying swords before Captain Preston marched his men to the customs house. The Crown then called its next witness, Thomas Marshall, who supported Garrick's statement, but added that although Captain Preston most certainly did have the time to order his men to cease fire between the first and subsequent shots, he did not. Four witnesses for the prosecution swore Captain Preston gave the fatal order to shoot. One of the four, eyewitness Daniel Califf, testified,
"I was present at the firing. I heard one of the guns rattle. I turned about and looked, and heard the officer who stood on the right in a line with the soldiers give the word fire twice. I looked the officer in the face when he gave the word and saw his mouth. I saw his face plain. The moon shone on it."
The next witness stated firmly that Captain Preston, standing behind his men, had given the order to fire. Two more witnesses would also testify they heard Preston give the order to fire. In all, a plethora of witnesses testified, all pointing the finger at Captain Preston. The prosecution had established a strong finish to the first day. The following day's testimony for the prosecution's case was not as powerful. Witness Theodore Bliss said Captain Preston had been standing in front of his men's guns. Bliss heard someone shout fire, but did not think it was the captain. Another testified that the crowd was shouting, "Fire, damn your blood, fire!" And a third witness said he heard the words fire come from behind the soldiers, all pointing to someone other than the captain. That was not the best way to end the prosecution. Trial lawyers prefer to start and end with strong testimony to leave a lasting impression on the jury. Ending with weak testimony shows that your case is, well, weak. A good trial lawyer on the defense side of the case will seize on that weakness, as John Adams did. Adams and Josiah Quincy put on their case the following day. They presented witnesses who described the angry crowd that rampaged the streets the night of March 5, 1770. The first witness for the defense stated firmly that it was British Corporal William Weems who had given the men the order to prime and load their muskets. Another said, quote, "The soldiers seemed to act from pure nature. I mean, they acted and fired by themselves." Adams did what every criminal defense lawyer worth their salt would do. Offer the Saudi defense. Some other dude did it. Point the finger elsewhere. It wasn't my client's order to fire, Adams claimed in closing. It was witness Richard Palms, however, who gave the loyalist jurors what they wanted to hear.
"I saw Captain Preston at the head of seven or eight soldiers at the custom house drawn up, their guns breast high and bayonets fixed. I saw something resembling snow ice strike the grenadier on the captain's right. The grenadier instantly stepped 1 foot back and fired the first gun. After the gun went off, I heard the word fire. I don't know who gave the word fire."
The next witness confirmed Palm's testimony.
"I jumped back and heard a voice cry, fire! It seemed to come from the left wing, from the second or third man on the left. The officer was standing before me with his face towards the people. I am certain the voice came from beyond him."
With these statements, Adams clinched the testimony necessary to establish his main argument. Someone other than Captain Preston gave the order. Still, Adams faced conflicting testimony. Prosecution witnesses blame Preston. Defense witnesses blame someone else. When you're faced with conflicting testimony, another part of the story requires you to paint your client as a fine, upstanding citizen. Defense witness Benjamin Lee said,
I saw Captain Preston as soon as the soldiers were ranged. A man went up to him and asked him if he was going to fire. Preston said, No, sir, upon my honor, if I can in any way avoid it. I knew the captain by sight and name. He had his regimentals, a hat on, his breastplate and sash round his body, and a sword in his hand.
Lawyers call that wrapping your client in the flag. The trouble here, of course, is that the English flag was presumably not highly favored with this jury. Character evidence is a tricky thing, especially in murder trials. Even so, Adams brought a friend to the stand, Thomas Handaside Peck, who said of Preston,
I was at home when the guns were fired. I heard them distinct. I went up to the main guard and addressed myself to the captain and said to him, What have you done? He said, Sir, it was none of my doings. The soldiers fired of their own accord. I was in the street and might have been shot. His character is good as a gentleman and soldier. I think it exceeds any of the corps.
Adams would also call upon prosecution witness Theodore Bliss's testimony about Captain Preston's position in the melee, which confirmed what Preston himself claimed, that he stood between his men in the crowd and that he would have caused his own injury had he given the order to fire. Adams had done what all good lawyers do in trials, introduce testimony that bolsters your side of the case and makes sense. He also took favorable testimony offered by the other side. By placing Captain Preston directly in the line of fire, Adams could convincingly argue that the good captain would never have ordered his men to fire because he would have been among the first shot and killed. Adams also solicited supportive testimony from common Bostonians, offering a more believable scenario than the testimony offered by the prosecution, who would oddly claim that the angry crowd had their backs turned to the redcoats. That is the best a trial lawyer can do. Weave a logical story from the testimony of witnesses that makes common sense and mixes it with the facts as we would believe them to have occurred based on how people really behave. It's the same way we argue cases now. Typical of the times, Samuel Quincy did not close the prosecution's case with a summation of the evidence. Instead, he quoted from legal treatises.
Not such killing only as proceeds from premeditated hatred or revenge against the person killed, but also in many other cases, such as is accompanied with those circumstances that shew the heart to be perversely wicked, is adjudged to be of malice prepense and consequently murder.
Snooze away here, because that's likely what the jurors did. Pompous legal phrases were as boring then as they are now, and typically they succeed only in putting a jury to sleep. Samuel Quincy's argument didn't persuade anybody. Unlike modern trials, where only one lawyer can stand up for each side, both John Adams and Josiah Quincy presented closing arguments. Quincy poked at the jurors.
You lobster, you bloody back, you coward, and you dastard are but some of the expressions proved. What words more galling? What more cutting and provoking to a soldier? To be reminded of the color of his garb, by which he was distinguished from the rest of his fellow citizens, to be compared to the most despicable animal that crawls upon the earth, was touching indeed a tender point. A soldier and a coward. Gentlemen of the jury, for heaven's sake, let us put ourselves in the same situation. Would you not spurn at the spiritless institution of society, which tells you to be a subject at the expense of your manhood?
No remaining record appears to exist of John Adams' closing argument in Captain Preston's trial, although in the next trial of the soldiers, his closing argument there gives an indication of what he would have said in Preston's case.
Facts are stubborn things, and whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passions, they cannot alter the state of the facts and evidence. Nor is the law less stable than the fact. If an assault was made to endanger their lives, the law is clear. They had a right to kill in their own defense. If it was not so severe as to endanger their lives, Yet, if they were assaulted at all, struck and abused by blows of any sort, by snowballs, oyster shells, cinders, clubs, or sticks of any kind, this was a provocation, for which the law reduces the offense of killing down to manslaughter, in consideration of those passions in our nature which cannot be eradicated. To your candor and justice, I submit the prisoners and their cause.
The jury returned a verdict of not guilty in favor of Captain Preston. With that finding, our small fledgling country took a giant leap onto the world stage. We showed the world that we could be a people governed by reason, not by unchecked passion. The soldiers' trial began some 8 months after Preston's trial finished. If King George wanted a conviction, then colonial juries did not present a problem for the crown. In many cases, England simply removed the accused criminals to be tried in England instead of allowing the case to proceed in the colonies. It was King George's practice of divesting Americans of jury trials that led the framers of our Constitution to include the right to a jury trial. That right first appears in Article 3, Section 2, and requires trial by jury in criminal cases. But in 1770, Crown Loyalists realized the tense situation in the colonies after the Boston Massacre. They knew the colonists would not tolerate the king taking his soldiers back to England for trial after killing their fellow citizens. The prosecution of the soldiers opened with a short introduction and proceeded to call a lengthy list of witnesses. Typical of the testimony offered by the prosecution, the second witness, Ebenezer Bridgham, was questioned by Samuel Quincy.
Did you apprehend the soldiers in danger from anything you saw?
I did not, indeed.
You said you saw several blows struck upon the guns. I should like you would make it more plain.
I saw the people near me on the left strike the soldiers' guns, daring them to fire, and call them cowardly rascals for bringing arms against naked men.
Did you see any person fall?
Yes, I saw Samuel Gray fall.
Witness after witness testified for the prosecution. Many testified without import because the lawyers simply were questioning witnesses without ever having talked to them prior to the trial. Many testified as patriots instead of eyewitnesses, following the lead of those who wanted the soldiers found guilty. A few, like Bridgham, testified with their observations of the events. One piece of key evidence introduced for the defense at the trial was the dying statement of Patrick Carr, one of the victims killed in the massacre. Whether Carr's testimony would be admitted into evidence depended on the hearsay rule, because Carr was not present in the courtroom for obvious reasons. Legal historians believe this testimony is the first recorded use of the dying declaration exception to the hearsay exclusionary rule. Carr's attending physician, Dr. John Jeffries, testified for the defense.
Was you Patrick Carr's surgeon?
I was.
Was he, Carr, apprehensive of his danger?
Yes. He told me he was a native of Ireland, that he had frequently seen mobs and soldiers called upon to quell them. He had seen soldiers often fire on the people in Ireland, but had never seen them bear half so much before they fired in his life.
When had you the last conversation with him?
About 4 o'clock in the afternoon, preceding the night on which he died. And he then particularly said he forgave the man, whoever he was, that shot him. He was satisfied he had no malice, but fired to defend himself.
As it is today, it was then. A finding of murder requires a finding of intent, here described as malice, before a man can be convicted of murder resulting in a sentence of death. Carr's testimony gave defense attorney John Adams the ability to argue for a lesser included charge of manslaughter, claiming that the soldiers felt threatened by the mob. At the conclusion of the trial, two judges, then known as justices, instructed a jury of 12 men, and in particular, Justice Oliver commented on this testimony, quote, "This Carr was not upon oath, it is true, but you will determine whether a man just stepping into eternity is not to be believed, especially in favor of a set of men by whom he had lost his life." The basis for the dying declaration exception to the hearsay rule lies in the belief that a dying man has no reason to lie. In his closing argument, John Adams argued from the soldier's perspective. If the soldiers were endangered by the mob, he reasoned, then they had the legal right to fight back and consequently were innocent. If they were provoked but not endangered, then they were at most guilty of manslaughter. Without a finding of malice, Adams argued, the jurors could not convict the soldiers of murder. He argued the defense's evidence and pointed out to the jurors the conflicting testimony presented by the prosecution.
However, it is apparent that witnesses are liable to make mistakes. By a single example before you. Mr. Bass, who is a very honest man and of good character, swears positively that the tall man, Warren, stood on the right that night and was the first that fired. And I'm sure you're satisfied by this time, by many circumstances, that he is totally mistaken in this matter. This you will consider at your leisure. The witnesses in general did not know the faces of these persons before. Very few of them knew the names of them before. They only took notice of their faces that night. How much certainty there is in this evidence, I leave you to determine.
Here is an ultimate lesson intact, one lost on many trial lawyers today. John Adams called Mr. Bass a liar, but did so in a most kind way, using flattery. With that kind of lead-in, the jurors knew Adams was not attacking the man. Instead, Adams sliced his attacks solely at the quality of Mr. Bass's testimony, not at Mr. Bass himself. Adams argued for 12 hours over 2 days. Worn out by the long speech, court reporter John Hodgson noted with bare kindness.
Mr. Adams proceeded to a minute consideration of every witness produced on the Crown side and endeavored to shoo from the evidence on that side, which could not be contested by the counsel for the Crown. But it would swell this publication too much to insert his observations at large, and there is the less necessity for it, as they will probably occur to every man who reads the evidence with attention.
Hodgson, at least, was convinced, which is quite an admission, because this man, who had documented innumerable trials, would have been the most qualified juror in the room if he had been a juror. As a trial lawyer, you know you've won when the court staff is on your side, and you'd be smart to get to know them well before the trial and rely on their observations of the witnesses. In all, 6 of the 8 soldiers were acquitted. The only 2 soldiers proven to have fired, Hugh Montgomery and Matthew Kilroy, were found guilty of manslaughter, a charge lesser than murder due to the jury's belief that they did not act with the required malice, just as Adams had argued. These 2 privates were punished by branding M on their thumbs to prevent them from using the same defense again, and were later discharged from the British Army, a comparatively minor punishment. For his part, John Adams called his defense of the soldiers, quote, one of the most gallant, generous, manly, and disinterested actions of my whole life, and one of the best pieces of service I ever rendered my country. Colonists bent on war with England saw these acquittals as bad decisions because the result robbed them of a rallying cry to further foment revolution. The English, on the other hand, saw the jury's verdicts as a vindication of their actions and perhaps as one of America's first tentative steps onto the world stage. Some trials, like this one, transcend those directly involved. In these 2 cases, the outcome was largely dependent on one man, John Adams. Had he not taken on these unpopular cases, the soldiers would have likely been convicted and probably hung by a mob. The victims of the massacre would have been hailed as heroes instead of rabble-rousers. Even today, our country's patriot propaganda attempts to cast the soldiers' actions as the Boston Massacre, an obvious attempt to disregard the actual outcome of the 2 trials. Don't get me wrong here. I was born in Worcester, Massachusetts, a somewhat distant Boston suburb, and I'm consequently proud of the city's role in the American Revolution. But it's hard to correlate the acquittals with a massacre. Had all the soldiers been convicted, the American Revolution may have occurred just that much sooner. Convictions may have had other consequences as well. Had he been the losing lawyer, John Adams would most likely have been forgotten by history. But instead, the Boston Massacre trials was one of the tipping points of his career as a practicing lawyer after his law practice dwindled away because of his unpopular defense of the soldiers. On the other hand, our country's leaders saw Adams' defense of the soldiers as a service to his country, which vaulted him first to vice president under George Washington, and then as America's second president. Thank you for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed this story. This episode was adapted from the chapter in my book, How Would You Decide? 10 Famous Trials That Changed History. So if you want the full story of the Boston Massacre trials and the other 9 trials covered in my book, please pick up a copy and learn all the details, testimony, and juicy bits that didn't make these episodes. You can buy copies on Amazon and all major booksellers. The book is published by Crimson Cloak Publishing, and I'm its author, J. Craig Williams. Thanks also go to our scriptwriter, sound designer, and sound mixer, Nathan Todhunter, our producer, Kate Kenny Nutting, Lisa Kirkman, our director of partnerships, and the publisher of my book, Carly McCracken of Crimson Cloak Publishing, who granted permission for the Legal Talk Network's adaptation. And a very special thanks to our voiceover actors, Scott Well, who played the role of John Adams, Alan Chudnow, who played the role of Samuel Quincy, Skylar C., who played the role of Josiah Quincy, Alan Parsons, who played the role of Captain Thomas Preston, Neil Harvey, who played the role of the British soldier, Robert Mattson, who played the role of Samuel Adams, Dan Ring, who played the role of Daniel Califf, Patrick Correa, who played the role of Richard Palms, Kate Kenny Nutting, who played the role of the female witness, Brian Dreesen, who played the role of Benjamin Lee, Andrew Clark, who played the role of Thomas Handaside Peck, Robert Terry Terelek, who played the role of Ebenezer Bridgham, Judd Pierce, who played the role of Dr. John Jeffries, as well as Christopher Rogers, who played the role of John Hogsdon. Thanks for the privilege of your time today. We look forward to seeing you again. I'm Craig Williams. Please stay tuned for our next episode of In Dispute on the Legal Talk Network.
The stars at night aren't the only things that are big and bright deep in the heart of Texas. With more than 100,000 actively practicing attorneys in the Lone Star State, we've got a whole bar of stars who know the ins and outs of Texas law. On the State Bar of Texas podcast, we talk about things like SpaceX, mass incarceration, the Texas Data Privacy and Security Act, and other discussions germane to the practice of law. Follow the State Bar of Texas podcast wherever you get your podcasts and start listening today.